This episode of Value Hive is brought to you by Tegas. If you enjoy listening to Value Hive, you'll love the Tegas product. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available expert interviews on all the public and private companies that you care about. All you have to do is log in. So if you're tired of high cost and time-consuming expert research calls, give Tegas a try and see for yourself why many of the most trusted and well-respected hedge funds, mutual funds, family offices, allocators, and VCs rely on Tegas to scale their expert research and to get the critical information they need faster than ever. You can sign up for a free trial at tegas.co/valuehive. That's tegas.co/valuehive. And as a personal anecdote, I use Tegas literally every single day. It's the first resource I use when I start researching a new investment, and it's one of the last things I do before I finish up rounding out my research, and I know you'll love it as much as I do. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, MARHELM.com to get your discount today. Alberto, I spent the Christmas break, I guess December 23rd through the 25th, 6th, listening to Twitter spaces, some led by Calvin Froge, some by others, on the crazy dynamics in the Red Sea and different trade routes with the Suez Canal being blocked, ships going around Cape Hope, I believe, and just general volatility in the shipping space. And I don't understand the industry well. I know a little bit about tankers, product tankers, you know, crude tankers, and then OSVs, I know a little bit, but shipping is an area that I have never really tried to understand. And part of that is, if you look at any of the charts on these shipping companies, they're all completely bombed out, just left for dead for years, some even decades. And whenever I see something like, whether it's a supply or demand shock, I start to get a little bit interested because maybe this is an opportunity. And after discussing with you before we hit record, it sounds like from a supply demand dynamic, there's a lot of similarities between what happened in, you know, some type of tanker markets, for example, product or crude tankers, and the same thing is happening in shipping. And so I wanted to get you on because you're an expert in shipping and you're a great follow on Twitter. And so before we dive into the nuts and bolts of shipping and the industry and the opportunity, give my listeners a quick background on who you are and how you got started studying this industry and analyzing shipping.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much for your invitation. It makes me happy to participate in your podcast. And sorry in advance for my English level. I hope to be good enough. I work now as an analyst. I'm responsible of research for a ship broker. The ship broker is an actor in the shipping space, which is between the charter and the ship owner. So when a charter wants to move a cargo of oil or refined products, which is my sector, they usually call us or another broker, and we provide them different options for the best position vessel, and we negotiate on behalf of them. So my role is to provide research for my clients and for my colleagues. So that, well, you know, maybe you know and your listeners know that this is a very volatile market. So it's really important to be well positioned because, you know, it's quite normal that rates can change 50% up or down in just 1 week. So imagine you're in a constant fight against the market, and you want to be the first one. So it's really important to have the good information. So it also makes a super interesting job and a super interesting market. And you know, I'm a mechanical engineering. That's my background, but I got into shipping because of a shipping company which was called TK LNG. I knew it some years ago, I think 5 or 6 years ago. It was super interesting because it was, you know, shipping, we'll talk about that, but I think it's very inefficient as a market, especially some years ago. Now it's more known, but this company, they had long-term contracts with a duration of between 10 and 20 years with tier one charters for LNG transport. So analyzing the company was as easy as doing a DCF. It was super cheap, so risk was very controlled, and the market was really inefficient valuating it, and it got finally took over. It was a huge winner for me, and I think it was bought at a very unfair price. So anyway, it was a huge winner. So I got interested through this company, and this company was owned by TK, which as well, they own a part of which is called TK Tankers, which is still listed. And that's why I got into the tanker space. There was that was in 2019. There was one regulation which was coming online, which was IMO 2020, which was supposed to be a game changer. In the end, I don't think it was like that, but it introduced some changes in terms of the fuel. And well, I don't want to get a lot of into this. We can talk about that later. But I saw the potential of a supply shock. So then this sector is as I said, super interesting. There are many histories about the tycoons, ship owners that have built fortunes, like Onassis, like Fredriksen. I got really into it, and finally I got a job in the sector. And well, I can say that it's I don't know, for me it's a dream. As you mentioned, I'm actually on my paternity leave. We are also on Christmas, and you know, this last weekend has been alternating meals with the family and regarding what the hotels were doing. So you cannot really disconnect when you're into it.
If we take a 30,000 foot view of the shipping industry over, let's say, the last couple of decades, and follow kind of the boom bust cycle of supply and demand, can you walk us through kind of, like you said before we hit record, around like post GFC 2008, 2009 to then where we are today, and maybe how different the market is from that point to now?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think the most important period to take a look at is this century. When it started, there was this China super development when they really got into the world trade. And, you know, that was a huge increase in demand from 2000 to 2007, 2008. And supply I would say in all subsectors, was not able to get it. So there was a boom, and as it happens all the time, when rates are very good, ship owners, they act on their own. This is like the prisoner's dilemma. They act on their own and they order new vessels. The thing is, these vessels, they, you know, when rates are high, everyone has their own spreadsheet, do for numbers, and everything's super, the returns are really good. The thing is that when these vessels, 2 years later, they get into the water, we say in this market that if you have 100 cargoes and 99 vessels, the market is super good. But when you have the contrary, everyone loses money, and that's really, you know, people really lose money here. It's catastrophic when you get there. So it's quite interesting to regard some shipping companies that have survived from those years. You can see stock prices collapsed and share count increased a lot at the lows. So the situation was catastrophic, and these were the seeds for the period we are living now, because there were many bankruptcies, there were many analysts that exited the sector. For a lot of people, this sector is still uninvestable. So this leads, on one hand, to inefficiencies, which are quite usual, and on the other hand, to a period where there was a very low number of orders of vessels. We refer to that as the order book. So for some years, in several sectors, it has stayed at 30-year lows. So normally, doing a simplification, demand tends to follow GDP growth. So when you have demand growing at 2% on average and an order book which is at 30-year lows, you get two imbalances. The first one during COVID with the container ship sector, where you had a constrained supply and a demand that exploded, first of all, because everyone was at home and we shifted consumption from services to goods. And then because we had another factor, which was congestion at the ports. So this led to inefficiencies in the trade. And benefits that year in container ship were extraordinary. Then next year we had the same situation in dry bulk, which is the transport of grains, iron ore, coal, etc. And since the Russian war against Ukraine started, we are living that in the tanker space, which is mainly crude and products. So I think that's a good summary, more or less.
And when you look across the shipping sector as a whole, how do you break down like that larger sector into smaller components? So you mentioned dry bulk, you mentioned, you know, certain containers, you mentioned products. Like, how do you see the market, and then how do you identify where the opportunities are? Is it just a function of the lowest order book is where I'll spend most of my time, or is it a little bit more nuanced than that?
Okay, so I mentioned dry bulk, tankers, and container ship. Then I would have to mention ro-ros, which is a transport of which is roll on roll off transport of cars, which is also a very interesting sector. And then mainly you have LNG and LPG, which are a little bit different. LPG is propane and butane, liquefied petroleum products, and LNG is liquefied natural gas, which is a bit more complex because it has to be a cryogenic. And Yeah, and then you have other more specialized sectors like supply for offshore and you know other subsectors. But I think those are the main one when we refer to shipping.
And then, go
so
ahead.
Each sector is a bit different, so you have some nuances. As you mentioned, supply for me is the most important, but you have to, but sometimes you have to look at the other side. For example, LNG. LNG, the demand is going, it's growing at a huge pace, and it's going to keep growing at that pace, I think, because of the energy transition. So that's one thing to look at. I think that I'm not an expert, but RoRo as well, I think it's growing a lot, mainly because of the booming of Chinese vehicles. LPG as well has grown a lot from the demand side. But if you ask me, what I look normally is the supply side. There are other nuances, like some sectors are very spot focused, so that makes it different, and others are more long term contract focused. For example, all these container ship vessels, they are normally owned by a ship owner, and they are leased in a long term contract for a liner like ZIM or like Maersk. Well, Maersk has own some vessels as well. For example, ZIM, they all their business, nearly, not all, but nearly all their business is leasing containers. So these contracts are normally long term. So this changes a little bit. As I mentioned before, TK LNG, they own the vessels, but as they were hired in those type of contracts, it's more a financial business than a shipping business. Okay, so this is a thing that also make attractive this sector for private equity, and you know, sometimes you see JP Morgan ordering vessels, because what they do, they own the vessel, but they put it on long-term contracts with a tier one charter, so it everyone's happy, and it's a good business. So what is important to summarize is that each subsector has a different dynamic, and this also makes the sector as a whole very interesting, because you can have a really poor market in dry bulk and a really good market in tankers, or the opposite. So you can always there's nearly always a bull market in a subsector of shipping.
I think the one shipping company that I've seen the most on Twitter/X is ZIM, ticker symbol ZIM. And from what I understand, is their business model basically subleasing shipping, where they'll lease a ship from a shipping company at, let's say, random numbers, $5,000 a day, and they hope that the spot price that they can charter it at is $15,000 a day. And then the money they make is the spread between the 15,000 and the 5,000, or is that completely wrong?
No, it's a little bit different. So they hire the vessel for, let's say, I don't know, a big vessel, maybe $40,000 per day.
Okay.
And then they charge customers for transporting containers. Like, imagine I'm living in Madrid. I want to move a container of finished goods from China to Madrid, because my business is imports. So I would pay them, imagine, $2,000 per container. So that's their business.
And so if I'm a new generalist investor to this space and I have no prior experience to shipping, I have all the preconceived notions that it's a net destroyer of capital, it's a terrible business, it's a terrible industry, you'll always lose money, and I want to learn about the space, what are some things that I can avoid that you see a lot of generalist investors like make mistakes in?
Well, that's maybe a difficult question. Well, one thing I try to say always is that we shouldn't follow FOMO in Twitter. You know, for example, this is we recently had a really good example last Friday. I saw a lot of FOMO in Twitter with ZIM, and yesterday it went to -20%. It ended in -12%. Today was -4% the last time I saw it. And the funny thing is that, well, there was one day that freight futures went down, but today they were up 20%. So even when a fundamental part of the business is improving, and for me, the most important thing, this is one thing. I want to say this because the other day I had an interaction. When you see, the spot rate today, for me, that's the past. Market is always forward looking. So you cannot say rates today are really good. No, market is looking forward. So it's much more important to take a look at futures, to get it and to see, to try to get a view on where the market is going. So, today I got up and I saw the freight futures were up 20% of the day, and yet ZIM is trading negative. And that's, I guess, because there was a lot of retail going in, hoping maybe for a short squeeze. ZIM is a name which has a lot of shorts. But the other thing I check, the number of shorts has not gone down. They're holding their positions, and I think maybe increasing. And retail, it's scared. So that's my guess. I don't know exactly, but that's what I think it's happening. So that's one of the things we should avoid. And the other thing, I don't know. I think you have to learn a little bit about the sector before going in. It's not that difficult sector, but you have to learn the basics. For example, one of the main things about a great part of the sector is that it's spot based. So as I mentioned before, you can see changes of rates of 50% from one week to another, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean the market is going down or up. You can see these huge variations in an upward trends or in a downward trends. So it's, if you come from the outside, it's really easy to get scared or to get the opposite. So so I think I would suggest people to learn a little bit, to read a little bit. And fortunately, there are many people in Twitter that are providing a lot of good information. Like you mentioned, Calvin. I would add Ms. Meyer and Ed Finlay, for example. There are many others, and it's people very generous in what they share. There's a ShipTweet community. So read about the sector, understand it a little bit, and then you can. And this is for me, it's a great sector because it's really inefficient. And if you really get to know it, you can make a lot of alpha, because there are movements of -5%, -10% with no reasons are really usual. And it's those days when you buy the dip, when you make a lot of alpha. Like, I don't know, I'm avoiding this situation because for me it's the chairs game.
Yep.
So I don't want to be there when the music stops. I probably get it wrong. It's not the first time I get it wrong with ZIM, because I bought a huge amount of ZIM when it I bought at $15, and I sold all my shares at 36. Then it got to 80. But I was sure that I didn't want to be there when the music stopped. So this time, I think the situation is even worse, because it changes really every day. And when you get the info, it's already late.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I don't want to be involved in.
So when you look at a new name or even a new kind of sector within shipping, what's your research process? Like, what are the first few things you do? Walk us through, if it's like, let's say it's not ZIM, let's say it's something else. Let's say it's, a dry bulk carrier and you don't know the business, but you obviously know the industry a little bit. What are your research process steps?
Okay. So the first thing you do, and when you get to know a little bit about a sector, like let's say dry bulk, you get a picture of supply and demand. Then getting from one company to another one is really easy, really straightforward. So that's a cool thing about it. And what you normally get is a price to NAV, a price to NAV table. So it's really easy to see. Well, for that, the main multiple that we use in this industry, it doesn't mean a lot because there are a lot of things inside, like, for example, management quality, loan to value, dividends, share repurchases. So not all the companies deserve the same multiple, but you have a first glance. If it's cheap or if it's expensive, then the loan to value is important, and then I think it's really important to focus on either catalyst, because some companies have a catalyst ahead, but for me the most important is the quality of management and what they do with the money they earn. We tend to forget that this is a super cyclical industry, mm-hmm. and if a shareholder doesn't get the returns, it's going to lose everything. So at one point, I mean. So so for me, it's very important. I tend to prioritize dividends, but I don't really care if I see management repurchasing at good prices. And the other thing is, as I mentioned, there are some poor quality companies, but they have catalysts ahead. Like, I don't know, they are changing the capital structure, or for example, they are highly levered and they are going to roll some long-term contracts. So the effect on the EPS is going to be huge. But what I've learned, I'm a value guy and I always chase the cheap stocks. But the more and more I learn about the industry, the more and more I prefer top quality managements. Even if you have to pay a little bit of a premium, but things are always much smoother.
And so let's say you're looking at two or three comparable companies and they're roughly, you know, similar on valuation. Let's say they're similar on management. Like, what are the 1 to 3 metrics that you rank, like, when you go through these things? Like, is it like, for example, a crude idea I have is, okay, you just find one that's got the cheapest price to NAV with the most decent management team. And that to me is kind of like, okay, that should be kind of in the top echelon. And then you go from there. But is price to NAV kind of the penultimate valuation metric? Or do you think it's a little bit deeper than that, where let's say a company trading at 0.8 times NAV with a better management is better than a company at 0.5 times NAV with a lesser management team?
That's what I mentioned. I tend to prefer companies with a better management. One other thing I forgot to mention is that you have to take a look as well as two vessel sizes, because the trade is not the same, and at some points you can prefer ones or another ones. And another thing is, well, operating leverage is obviously bigger in bigger sizes, but sometimes this is a misconception. You tend to think that bigger sizes will always earn more. This is not always the case. They have the potential to earn more, but it's not always the case. One good example is the Aframaxes, which are smaller than Suezmaxes and VLCCs, and they have earned the most since the Russian conflict because of the specific trade they do. The other thing I like to focus a lot, and I think this is when I open my spreadsheet, I tend to calculate the cash break-even, daily cash break-even. So it's not difficult to model these type of companies. What I do is calculate the cash break-even, bringing all the cost to a daily basis. And that gives you a really good starting point to calculate free cash flow. And then when you calculate free cash flow, you can see, well, if you have a company that it's giving you the entire cash flow as dividends, you have your dividend yield, you can estimate what dividend yield is going to price the market. So you have your potential there. That's pretty straightforward. Or or if not, you can at least you can see how much the NAV is going to increase because of that free cash flow. So yeah, that's another important metric.
When you're looking at these daily breakevens, do you do almost like a reverse DCF where you take the stock price or you take the market cap and you try to find out, okay, what is the market assuming the breakeven or the cash flow rate is on a daily basis for this business? So for instance, like let's say the breakeven is $40,000 a day and the, you know, spot price or whatever the contracts that they're averaging is 60,000. So you've got a $20,000 a day breakeven margin, but the stock price is so low that the market's assuming that it's like, you know, a $5,000 to $10,000 breakeven. Do you do any of that, and how, you know, reliable is that or how useful is that?
No, that could be interesting, but I tend to keep things simple and more simple than that. So no, well, as I mentioned, what I do normally, sometimes I build complex models, but it's not useful. So you build a pretty simple model with historical data of the company. You calculate cash breakeven. You see how is it evolving. I focus a lot on debt refinancing. And then I calculate free cash flow. It's important to know that in shipping you always calculate free cash flow after the debt repayment. And then I see what the company is going to do with this free cash flow. And then I see what the price to NAV is. And I tend to think what would be the correct multiple. For example, I don't know, my favorite tanker company, which is Okeanis. When I see them trading below NAV, I see there's an opportunity. I mean, for example, 1 month ago, they were trading below NAV. They were listing their stock in USA, which I think is a good catalyst, even though there's not much liquidity. But I think it's good because for American investors, they have some problems to invest in this stock in the Oslo Exchange, so I think it's useful. And the perspective for the next 2 years are very good, and you see them trading below NAV. You know, even if you build a really conservative model, you get to a 15 dividend yield for next year. They're giving all the free cash flow as dividends. Right after that moment, the CEO bought a lot of stock. So I mean, in that case, it's pretty straightforward. You see them trading below NAV or Frontline, for example, which is a more known name. If you see Frontline trading below NAV, it's always a buy. Then you have low quality. You know, I've been invested a lot in Sacos. Sacos is a low quality name which is trading at 0.3 NAV. Wow. I mean, there were some catalysts. Some of them they have played out and they're still trading around those numbers. I don't think we're going to see them trading above 0.5 NAV never. So that's you have to understand a little bit what are the implications of each company. But then you get to an idea of what is the adequate multiple, more or less.
And I think that's you kind of segued perfectly into what I wanted to discuss next, because this conversation goes beyond just shipping and involves every cyclical industrial business, which is what's an appropriate multiple in different economic cycles or even through the cycle. And so, for instance, if I'm looking at something like an OSV, like a Tidewater, you know, which we own or something like that, like what is an appropriate multiple? Is it 4 to 6 in, through the cycle? Is it 7 to 9 in an up cycle? Is it 2 to 3 in a down cycle? And when it comes to shipping in particular, I know there's a few different, you know, categories of shipping. You mentioned Capesize. I think you mentioned VLCCs. And I think there, and you also mentioned Afromax, and then there's, I think there's like Handy Size or something like that. And so when you look across these different, we'll call them flavors of shipping companies, do each, you know, or does each flavor have their normalized NAV, even through like a down, up, and mid cycle?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think really difficult to answer. You know, when I make when I have these thoughts, I always try to remember myself that investing is more an art than a science. So there are no adequate answers. What I've seen when I first got into shipping, I saw some professionals, which I'm in contact with, that they normalize through the cycle. So it's like they revert to the mean. So in that case, you know, you can take, for example, the 20-year average for earnings, and then you input that as earnings, and then you calculate. And then if you're below below that, you can expect a mean reversion, especially if supply and demand are optimistic for the future. But what I've seen about what I'm not comfortable about that is that you sell too early. You know, for example, all these professionals, they have sold, for example, international seaways in the 30s or 35. Now it's trading at 46 or 47, depends on the day, with a lot of dividends paid out since then. So there's a lot of money you leave on the table. So for me, you have to get that's a good starting point. So one of the things a good exercise is to normalize earnings to the 20-year average or to the 15-year average, so you can see how deviated you are from there.
Yep.
So imagine, let's say VLCCs, which is a tanker that can carry 2 million barrels. Let's say the 20-year average for earnings is 45,000 per day, and today, I'm going to invent it. Today they're earning 100,000 per day. That should make you uncomfortable. You have to be very sure about the market going forward to get involved when you are so deviated from the historical average. Now, imagine you are on the contrary. VLCCs are earning 35,000 per day, while the 20-year average is 45. That would make me comfortable to invest. And the other thing is that these rates, they are not inflation adjusted. So it gets even better. And answering your question about the multiple, this is
it's almost an impossible question, but like I want, because one thing that I struggle with is if I'm too conservative, like let's say I want to be conservative in my valuation. And I'm just going to say, look, I want to make sure that this shipping idea pencils at 0.5 NAV. Mm-hmm. And my worry, and again, this is worrying about right tail risk, is my worry is if we get an upcycle, these things will reprice around 1 to maybe 1.25 times NAV. And if I don't have that toolkit to say, okay, like this is what could happen in an upcycle, then there's a lot of opportunities that I could miss on the right tail. Now, granted, like I could obviously miss on the left tail as well, but like there is an element where if you're too conservative in your valuations in these cyclical names, like you can miss the magnitude of a lot of these moves.
Yeah, well, I can give you an example. For example, Tidewater that you mentioned, and I owned until recently. You know, when I saw it in the 50s, 55, I thought, man, this price is stupid. I wrote a lot of put options and bought the stock. Now I see it in the 70. Today was 77. I think I don't have my numbers here, but I would say that's nearly 7 times EBITDA for next year.
Yeah.
No, they have to roll a lot of contracts next year, so they have some hidden earnings potential.
Yeah.
But for me, that's expensive. So that's what I sold. And you know, it's the market leader. It's monster. I love the the company, a lot of management. I think they have a lot of potential to increase earnings and to do more M&A in the sector. But as I said before, I'm more I'm a classical value guy, so I tend to, when I sell, there's a lot of there's some money left on the table, but I don't want to collect the last penny. So in shipping, more or less, you know, one of the in the rest of the shipping, which I know a little bit more about, there are some tools that you can use. For example, you can see new building parity. Okay, so you can construct this line of a straight depreciation from new build price to scrap value, and you can plot against it the price of the vessels for the different ages. So this new building parity line, it's like a magnet. If you're deviated from there, you know that the risk is high. For example, I always keep in mind the container ship new building parity in 2021, where you know, it was super, super deviated. Vessel prices, they didn't make any sense. But rates were there, so people were kept buying them. You know, the pain was going to come. You didn't know when, but now in tankers, you, for example, or in dry bulk, you see you're not that deviated, and you can do some exercises to see if there's room for increase in the price of the vessels. You know, for example, one important thing to measure is yard capability for the next years, the order book as well. So if you have a healthy demand and supply is going to get constrained, you have some room for vessel prices to increase. You can also, this is one exercise I do a lot. I take a new build price and I get what the rate I would need as a ship owner to get a 12% return on the vessels with different debt assumptions. So you know, comparing that level to the historical average, you can get to an idea if you are really deviated or not, if there's room for price increases, and that's what is going to increase NAVs mainly. Yeah. So that and cash generation. So putting together these dos factors, you can see if there's some room to grow or not.
Yeah, and that's like my friend Judd Arnold, who's a frequent guest on the podcast, and he was pounding the table on Tidewater forever. He got me, he really taught me the benefits of using those new build economics for understanding upside. But when you also look at things like replacement costs, how often or how important is that in your analysis, where it's, I guess it's kind of like price to NAV, but in a sense, you know, there's also the replacement costs are different, whether it's a VLCC versus an Aframax versus a Handysize or whatever. And so, you know, do you kind of have a point where, hey, I'm only going to buy, or I only want to buy companies that are trading at 30% of their replacement costs or 50%, or you, do you kind of know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally understand. And I think it's another really good point of view. That's not my main focus, but I think it's also super interesting. But, you know, the first time I read or I listened about offshore drilling, you know, the comment I listened to was, these companies, they trade below replacement cost. They trade below their steel value. And then they went on to bankruptcy later. So that's a bit dangerous. So you have to couple it with capital structure, debt, and everything. You know, for example, one of the theses that I loved, I never got involved because it was a bit complex for me, was Valaris, when they went after bankruptcy, they went out. There was a Capi who was really loud about it, and it has been a home run for him. And I love that this is getting out from bankruptcy completely with a healthy balance sheet. But yeah, I think replacement cost is a bit dangerous if you don't understand the full picture. But of course, who wouldn't like to buy below replacement cost? I mean, that's pure value investing, no?
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the shipping industry, and you said that you like to focus on capital structures, and this is going back in the conversation, but I wanted to bring it up. What are you seeing in terms of financing and loan maturities and the ability of these shipping companies to either refinance or extend maturities, let's say, from the next 2 years to a few years out? Because I think that's another kind of catalyst play that you mentioned is, hey, here's a company that's got random numbers, $500 million that was due in 24. They were able to refinance and push out to 28. And that's, if you can get 2 to 3 years in an upcycle of outsized earnings, I mean, you've got a 4-year window where now you can use that cash instead of paying off the maturity. You can use it, like you said, to return it to shareholders.
Yeah. So another thing interesting about this sector is that it's highly you can leverage a lot these vessels. That is highly liquid in terms of second-hand sale and purchase. You know, every week I track all the transactions that I can. And every week you see, I don't know, like 10 sale and purchase of vessels, only in tankers or only in dry bulk. So it's for some banks or some financial institutions, they are very comfortable financing this type of assets because you can... It's like a mortgage, and if they don't get paid, they can get the asset and they could sell it in just a week. So that's a good thing about this sector. But the first thing is because returns are not good unlevered, so you can improve your returns. And the second thing is because sometimes you have really good opportunities in the debt on these companies. Some of these companies, they have bonds that are trading. Tidewater is one of them. You know, when I got the prospectus about the last bond that Tidewater put into the market, and it was paying at par, it was paying 10.4% on a 2026 maturity. So for me, it's super easy money. I mean, Tidewater is not going to go to bankruptcy, or they're not missing these payments. There are other companies that have long-term contracts with tier one charters, like, for example, Diana Shipping, which is dry bulk. So the equity is a complete mess, but they have bonds that, when I look at them, they were trading at 11% yield on a 2026 maturity as well. And they have, their debt is really good, really well covered by the time charters and by the asset value. So there's nearly zero risk of impairment in this debt. But as you have no rating, for example, and as nobody wants to hold a shipping debt, they pay a huge deal. So that's great. That's great.
How do you think about forecasting this industry? Like when you're analyzing a company, let's say it's Diana, or let's say it's TK or something like that. How far do you look out? Is it 2 to 3 years? Is it 3 to 5? Is it even shorter than that? Maybe 12 to 18 months? Because you mentioned the volatility of the underlying freight rates can be significant. And so one of the things with this business, or really with any kind of cyclical business, is the farther you look out, the more volatile and the less reliable that prediction becomes, because you wake up one morning, this morning, and freight rates are up 20%. You could go to bed and wake up the next day and they're down 20%.
Yeah.
And so how do you, I guess, outside of these long-term contracts where some of these shipping companies have, let's say, 85% of their revenue is booked for this year and 50% next year, how do you then model that out, and how far are you willing to look out?
Well, as I mentioned before, maybe the most important factor is the order book. And the order book, it normally takes 2.5-3 years to be digested. So that's that's for me the limit. But I try to focus on 1 or 2 years because things can change a lot. And I I don't like to get a false sense of safety. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a super cyclical industry, and you have to take a look day by day. As I mentioned before, you have to zoom out a little bit to not get wrong because of this volatility, daily volatility. But you know, the time frame is I would say 1-2 years maximum. Mm.
Yeah, and it's interesting in this space because you have to both zoom in for your forecast of 1-2 years, but in order to stick with the name through the volatility, you also have to zoom out and look at something like the order book. And so the day-to-day volatility, or even the quarter-to-quarter, year-to-year volatility can be significant. But again, if you can step back and say, okay, the order book is still at, you know, 3-4%. Like, that's the thing with like some of these product tankers or some of these offshore service companies. It's, mm-hmm. you know, the order book is below 5%, and you've got a global fleet where half or 30-50% of the fleet is at retirement age. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the ability to both zoom in on your forecast but zoom out to hold conviction is an interesting skill that needs to be acquired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one funny thing about it, well, not that funny because it has been bad for me, is yeah. when I started working in this industry, I got worse as an investor because, you know, all my colleagues, they are trying to forecast next week move. And it's really easy to get into that mood of trying to forecast next week move. So you lose this perspective. That at the first time got you into the sector. So you get really, really short termish, and it's counterproductive as an investor. Yeah.
So if I'm trying to build a portfolio of these shipping container industrial names, let's say I don't want to be 100% exposed. Like, I don't want it to be 100% of my portfolio, but I want a portion of my portfolio to have exposure to shipping. How would you construct that portfolio? Would you have a basket of names? And then if so, how would you manage that in terms of position size? Would you have, you know, a bunch of 1-2% positions, or maybe a few larger 5-7% names?
It depends. One thing I like a lot, it's selling put options. To get into these names, it's not the case anymore. But historically, they have paid really well. Now volatility is surprisingly low, but yeah, and then I don't know. I don't think it's really, apart from special cases with catalysts, in each sector, maybe you can have one or two names. It depends. Also, if you want to focus on different subsectors, you know. But for example, I don't know. I would keep Okeanis in the crude sector. Maybe in the clean sector, you know, you have, well, International Seaways is in the middle. You have also Scorpio Tanker, which is clean focus, only product. You have D'Amico, which has been a really good one for me. But the difference is not really high between them. So maybe one or two names per sector. In the dry bulk, maybe you wanna have, I would say, Himalaya Shipping or 2020 Bulkers, which are more focused on there's a bigger difference because these two names, for example, they are only focused in the bigger sizes and only in iron ore trading. Mm-hmm. And then you can like to have Starbulk Carriers or Golden Ocean, which are more mixed fleets, to be exposed to grain or to smaller trades. And about concentration, I don't know, it depends on what point of the cycle you are. You know, yeah. I understand this as, in this cyclical investing, I try to divide between two main situations. One of them is when you are at cycle lows, which is the most painful and the most difficult to see, because mm-hmm. you can be right and still be get a minus 30% as a welcome package. But that's the most interesting one, and that drives you multi-baggers. For example, the first time I bought Okeanis was trading at 60 NOK, and now it's trading nearly at 2080 with many dividends in the middle. For Dam Eco, it has been it has multiplied by 4, I think, in the last two to three years. But it's more difficult and it's more painful. The other situation, which I think it's easier and it makes a lot of sense, is when you think that a good situation is going to last more than the market is thinking. So, for example, that would be the case of tankers now. Tankers, the greatest part of the money has already been made. It doesn't mean you can have a 50% return in the next year, but you're not going to multiply by 3. The good thing is that it's easier to see the situation. Mm-hmm. And the situation is much better. You know, for example, LTV of these companies is much more manageable. Liquidity issues are not there. The balance sheets are healthy, so they can stand longer in depressed periods.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you see the rates there that are good and that are keeping high. So it's easier, and that's another situation. But on the other hand, it's dangerous because it can end any day. But, so apart from event-driven situations, I tend to differentiate between these two situations. And when I'm in the first one, I tend to concentrate a lot. For example, in Dam Eco or in Okeanis, I had 30% of my portfolio at some points. Now I wouldn't do that sort of things, because mm-hmm. you know, it's you could get a good correction and you're not at the same point. I don't know. It's easy to forget sometimes that in this kind of sectors you are exposed to disasters. You know, in Drywood, for example, in 2019, you have a mine in Brazil that collapsed, killing a lot of people, and was a disaster for the sector. Not that long ago, we had Prestige, the tanker that spilled all the oil near the coast of Galicia in Spain. So it's easy to forget that you're supposed to, or imagine it. I don't think it's going to happen, but related to the Red Sea situation, if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, the market is going to lose at least 8 million barrels per day of oil.
Mm. Yeah.
So you're going to get to a situation where it's going to be, well, oil is going to the moon, but there's going to be an oversupply of tankers. So, once again, I don't think this is going to happen, but it's just an example that comes to my mind that mm-hmm. things can change very, very quickly. And I don't think it's the moment of the cycle to be really concentrated. On the other hand, I see that there are returns to be made. So, yeah.
What's your strategy for selling put options? Because I always find that fascinating. And there's a handful of investors I've had on the podcast that use that strategy to enter. And then, like you mentioned, selling calls on the upside to get out of positions.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you develop that strategy? What IV are you looking for to sell the puts? And, you know, how do you think about that whole process?
Okay. So first of all, I love this because, you're selling volatility. It's a strategy where time goes in your favor. So you say that that passes, you're earning money. So and you can earn money without the price change. So even if the price stays, you're going to earn money. Sometimes annualized returns are awesome. So I love to do that, and especially when there's fear in the market, like last time was with Tidewater. Unbelievable for me, at least, you know, but I think as the whole process it depends a little bit on the company, but what I try to do is 10% out of the money and 2 months expiration.
Okay.
And instead of looking at implicit volatility, what I tend to calculate is annualized return. and I want to be normally above 40%. But it depends on the situation. You know, for example, outside shipping, if I see this a special situation where the downside is covered, I can lower a little bit this. For example, I don't know if you know Barford.
Yes.
But, well, last week, put options were paying 4% in a month. So 48% annualized yield in a situation where I think downside is totally covered.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I would have sold them for less, or even less. And in shipping, I don't know if in all these more or less 40% annualized yield, I'm happy, and I think 1 or 2 months is the best time frame for me. I think that's the optimal. And one of the things that I do is that when I earn a big part of the money in the first part of the time, I tend to cover that. I mean, Okay. Imagine I sell a put for $100, and I can repurchase it for 2 months, and I can repurchase it for 60, or no, for 40. So a $60 benefit in 1 week, I would do that because the annualized yield would be much lower, and you keep all the risk. So that's one of the things I try to do. So I trade a lot. I almost never get into expiration date with the options opened.
Okay, so you'll close out the option before expiry?
Yeah, that's one of the things I normally do, yeah.
And is that like a week before, a few days before, the day before?
It's it all depends. Normally when I get 80% of the...
Okay.
Yeah, of the value of the option.
And so are you looking for that 40% annualized net of selling early? So even at 80% of the value you realized, do you still get that 40% annualized return?
Well, annualized is normally better, because imagine if I'm selling an option today with 2 months expiration,
yeah,
and for 40% yield, but I'm able to close that option in 1 week for half of the value.
Yes, the math still works.
Much, much better.
Yes.
So that's a simplification. I don't want to be misunderstood. Mm-hmm. The thing is that I want to be really opportunistic. So yeah. When I get to do this really high annualized return, I do them. I'm not going to get all the time for these opportunities, but when I get them, I try to benefit from them.
Mm-hmm. So, and then when you sell the calls, is it the same sort of thing, 10 to 12% out of the money, 1 to 2 month time frame?
Yeah, more or less I do that, yeah. It's not an strategy I like that much. Mm-hmm. Because your stupid face is sometimes is unimaginable. Sorry. You always sometimes get a stupid face, which is really, really, I don't know, imagine. Last time I got screwed about that was selling calls of Torm, which is a product player. I think I was selling as well 25, and I saw it go into the 30s before the expiration. So I don't like that feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it would suck if you've got covered calls and you sell them and then you exit half or 70% of your position, and then all of a sudden the stock goes from 30 to 50 to 60, yeah, and you miss out on it.
I prefer to sell early.
Yeah,
I don't get that feeling when I sell early, because at least I have the money and I can redeploy it. But when I sell a call option, I don't have the money. The option is open and the money is deployed, and I have to wait until expiration to get the money back. So you can operate on margin, but it's not exactly the same. So so that's why I don't have any problem with selling early. I've understood that it's impossible to anticipate the valleys or the tops. So I'm really good about that. But the strategy I like the most is to sell put options. And the other good thing is that sometimes you can leverage your account without paying for that.
So, yeah, that's a strategy I want to start implementing, at least, you know, dipping my toes in for 2024, for, you know, especially if I'm following more of these volatile markets that are, you know, cyclical and have those, like you mentioned, Tidewater from a couple months ago, just huge down days,
yeah,
and then just recovered and is now past, I think, yearly highs. So
For example, that's a good example. I was selling strike 50 options for Tidewater, yeah, which I thought it was free money.
Yeah.
The recovery was so fast.
Yep.
The expiration was in January, but the recovery was so fast that I earned nearly all the value of the options in just 2 weeks. So,
wow, you know,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's awesome. This has been a great conversation, and I want to end with a few closing questions. The first one being, what areas of shipping or tankers have you most excited right now? Are there any new names that you're studying that get you excited as we enter 2024?
Well, that's a tricky question. I will give you an answer that I don't know if you're going to like, but the most excited I'm about for next year is copper mining.
I love that, man. I love that answer.
Philo and NGX, which are,
yeah, I own NGX, and that's been good to me this year.
By the landings, and I'm super excited about both. So this is going to be my area of focus next year. I think there's some money to be made in the shipping sector. There's always money to be made. There are a lot of inefficiencies. The last one I saw, and I've seen two recently, which are quite amazing. Mm-hmm. Which was so I'm going to talk about this just to give the idea that you have to be looking at opportunities all the time in shipping. Sometimes they arise in one day. And for example, one interesting one was there was a takeover of TGH. I don't remember if it was Triton or TGH. Textainer Holding. So there was these two companies, Textainer and Triton. They have both been taken over. They own the boxes, the containers, and they lease them. And in this last takeover, when the press release was released, in the press release, it was a mention that they were going to buy the preferred stock as well. And, there are a lot of preferreds trading in shipping, and that's a super inefficient market. It's amazing. For example, in 2020, there was a fund that blew up.
And, yeah, I remember that. I remember that. That was crazy.
There was a huge opportunity in preferred stock. I made a lot of money there. And this last time, when I saw the press release, I don't think it's going to work, but I was able to buy a bunch of preferreds pre-market and do a 30% benefit in just minutes. I was able to buy all the position in pre-market and exit in pre-market because, I don't know, people don't pay attention about that. It's a super inefficient market, and it was amazing. And another last opportunity last week, which I shared with some pals, was NET. NET is going to, it's a wind, well, we started talking about wind turbines, and finally we haven't talked about that. Yeah. But NET, they're being acquired by Cadeler.
Yeah, I was reading that.
So there was a tender offer, and shareholders had to accept it. The ones that had not accepted, their stock is going to be purchased at $11.37 per share next week. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why I was able to buy unlimited stock at 11.02 last week. So it was at 3% zero risk in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
The good thing is that I was able to sell it even in the next day for 11.30. So I mean, it was like an arbitrage, no risk, unlimited position. You could go with margin as well. So this kind of inefficiencies, they always exist. So it's not like saying I'm excited about a concrete position for next year, but yeah. I'm excited that there will always be some opportunity like a sell-off in tight water or these kind of arbitrages or something like that.
Yeah, and that's so. How do you find? I mean, do you just have like a list of all the preferred stock and shipping companies, or is there like a website to go find all that? How do you figure all that out?
No. I more or less have in mind. My mind, which company have preferred, but it's not something I take a look at them normally. But when I see a takeover, this is the first thing I look at because I know from previous experience that it's super inefficient.
So, what's your daily research process or reading process like? How do you find these ideas? Because one of the things that I'm picking up on is you're not necessarily screening for companies, but you're reading the news, you're reading press releases and things in the industry, and then that's how you're finding ideas. So how are you, like, what sources are you reading, what websites, anything like that?
So my main information source is Twitter, or X now. You follow the right people, it's amazing. And it's a great tool to connect with people. Like, for example, we have connected through Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really happy, as I told you before, about this opportunity to participate in your podcast. Twitter is a main source of information. You following the right people. I mentioned some names before. I would like to add maybe Original Braila, which is a Swedish super investor, and also... And it's very sharp. Also, Joeri. Joeri is also very sharp, very participative, and they share a lot of info. And I think that when you start following these names, you're going to get suggestions or retweets, or you're going to build your network of ship tweet people. And that's a very good source for new ideas. And then, well, what I do is I read specialized newspapers like Tradewind, Splash, and I don't know, my daily routine consists of on tracking vessels, on tracking the market, on see what are the owners doing, getting in contact with them. So that's my daily routine.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter/X, if you can follow the right people or even create lists for different categories, it is probably the best news source out there. Speaking of Twitter and all these contact forms, if people are listening and they want to get in touch with you, where can they go to either talk to you, read your research, all that?
Twitter, I think, is the best place. It's difficult to pronounce in English my account. You can share it, I think.
Yeah, well.
I try to share a lot of things. One of the things I love about Twitter is the people you get into contact with. Even if I've always seen the money business as a complicated one in terms of trustworthiness of people, I've learned through the time that there are many amazing people there, willing to share information, willing to share their ideas, willing to explain you everything. So I like to give something back to the community, and I try to share things that I, for example, some research that I do for my job, and I think it can be interesting. I try to share it, and I try to engage into constructive conversation as well, and so Twitter is the best way. And feel free to contact me. I try to answer every message I get.
Yeah, and the handle is at @AyusoValue, AYUSO Value.
That's
the Twitter handle there. And then the final question I have for you, Alberto, if you could have dinner with any person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Wow. I've never thought about that, but I think definitely it would be Yeah, I think maybe Droim, the ship owner involving Golar LNG and other companies like 2020, Himalaya, etc., or Aristoteles Onassis, or one of these tycoons. I have the chance to meet Fredriksen, just a shake of hands, but when you're in front of Fredriksen would be another good option. When you're in front of these people and you see all they have built, I'm amazed about that, and I'm always willing to hear their history and learn from them. You know, Aristoteles Onassis, he started smuggling tobacco, and he was one of the biggest ship owners of history. So I'm really fan of this type of growth histories.
Yeah, that's awesome. That would be a great conversation to have. Alberto, thanks so much for coming on, man. I appreciate you letting me pick your brain on the shipping space. I think it's a fascinating industry as we look out towards next year. And I think you said it best. There's always opportunities to make money in this space. You just have to look and wait for these, wait for these situations to arise. So best of luck next year. And you know, I think you're one of the better follows on Twitter, and I hope you go from 12,000 to 20,000 to 40,000 on there.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the opportunity. I hope I made myself understood. And
you did great.
Thank you very much, and I hope the best for you for next year.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.